Ladies and gentlemen, the Deep Thoughts. This is a result of a post that someone made that recommended IC Fahrenheit 451. Very helpful, because it brought out something that I have been thinking about for quite some time and talking to friends about. It has to do with book burning. If I told you, hey, they're going to burn books again, you just wait. I say a statement to you. You should automatically go, no, they're not. What the fuck are you talking about? Because in your brain, you're thinking, well, one, society would be repulsed at such a notion, but two, how many books are there anymore? I did not get raised with an education that forced me to read these classic books. Virtually all of the classic books I am yet to read. Oh, sure, I got the Cliff Notes and all that good stuff, but I have not read Moby Dick, Huckleberry Finn, Fahrenheit, 451. I told you I couldn't read Catcher in the Rye. I tried to. There was no imperative by the time I got to school to read that kind of content. I went to college several times, off and on. I wasn't taking any necessarily literary courses. That's probably where I would have been forced to push through some of these volumes. And now my life has such a velocity that pausing to read anything fictional is, it just makes me feel like I'm losing out on something I would write that's brand new and fictional. Sort of naive, in a way. But you got to go with your gut, right? And my gut always says, no. That's for people who read. You're a person who writes. Let us help you write something new. Book burning. If I tell you, like I started out with, let's do some predictions on book burning and stuff, we'd all come out with probably zero, right? And yet I think it's happening in an organic way, right in front of our face, and we're not paying attention. And I have to say, it's one of these things that if the world was run by good people, it probably wouldn't be happening, but maybe it would. Maybe it would organically occur, what I'm about to assert here. It's very, very simple. Bookstores are going out of business around the world. The biggest bookstore chains are struggling to keep the doors open, right? Where are all the books going? In school nowadays, the schools are rushing into these iPads, tablets, telephones, mostly tablets, bigger file format, right? Bigger screen format, I should say. We have all kinds of really cool reading tablets, some that look like paper. And that is getting rid of publishing books. And there may be nothing wrong whatsoever with migrating out of cutting down trees and turning them into pulp and then making books out of them, making it all electronic. There may not be anything wrong with that technically, just like socialism, if it could be ever realized without oligarchs above us, being these rich elite that control the socialism experiment. Always putting in the least amount of material wealth into a socialistic environment to make them pacified, right? And to understand that comment just before we get into this, because we're setting the scene in the mind here. Why can't we go all electronic without a problem? How many of you guys have bought a product your whole life? Whatever that might be, a candy bar, a computer, piece of equipment, a blender, a vacuum cleaner, whatever. And when you were a kid, you remembered that the product was made out of really high quality metal and plastic and glass or whatever. And now it's the cheapest fucking thing they could possibly make, right? I was having a funny conversation with my buddy at the Smoke Lounge a few hours ago. And, you know, when you mass produce a product, you want to technically reduce all of its components to make it as easy to make, but also as affordable to make. And we're talking about routers. He was just asking me, he has a bunch of old routers. He asked me if I wanted them. And I said, nah, it's all right. And then this kicked off this conversation where, because we both finished Fahrenheit 451. And I said, you know, isn't it funny that when you call up the phone company and you're reporting a problem with your router, one of the first things they want you to do is to turn it off for like 8 to 10 seconds and then turn it back on. But they don't put an on switch on the router, even though that is the first thing they want you to do is turn it off and turn it on. So you're pulling the plug out of the back of a router, holding it in your hand. And then, you know, if it's dark or, you know, you've done what most of us do, you try to hide the power lines behind your TV, behind your entertainment center, wherever the hell you keep your modem. Sometimes you might drop it and it goes way back behind a counter. You're like, son of a bitch. And then these things have like a round and a, like they have two points of contact. One's round, one's square. So you might have to line that. It's just ridiculous. A little tiny switch would put them out maybe, without a joke, 5 to 10 cents a machine, but they won't do it. And that's how corporations do it. They put the least amount of effort in to sell you a product. That's what governments do. They put the least amount of money in to make the people happy. The rest of the money goes to their private foundations / pork spending products that, their buddies who build bridges give them a kickback on the side, buy them a house, buy them a boat, whatever. It's a gift. It's a whatever. Printed material is becoming unpopular. Electronic material is becoming the way to ingest material. And I've said this a couple times on the show. I'm going to say it one more time because we're here. There's a group of gifted kids in Los Angeles who have figured out that when you read from an iPad or a tablet from a screen that is flickering at 60 frames a second, your brain does not remember the material that much. But when you read it from a book, it's like a movie, it becomes a part of your life, and you can't forget it. And so these kids are refusing to read anything off tablets. Isn't it interesting how the kids are the ones that are going, I don't think so. In America, there's a bookstore called Barnes & Noble. It is one of our popular remaining bookstore chains. All the rest have gone out of business that I know of. I don't even know of another one. We used to have B. Dalton. They're gone. We used to have Borders. They're gone. So you have private bookstores and Barnes & Noble, as far as I know. And Barnes is really struggling to stay in business. Now, if you're fond of books, like I am, I will go in and buy a book on philosophy, a book on coding, a book on science. Something to learn something, right? Unfortunately, these publishers have been infiltrated for, you know, at least a century. And so what you get in some of these categories are, you know, just as bad as not reading it. Probably you're better off not reading some of this stuff. But there are certain things that are mathematical that you can learn. You buy a book on chemistry. Well, chemistry's chemistry, man. If it didn't work, it wouldn't work, and therefore the knowledge would be worthless. Buy a book on calculus, right? Let's fast forward 10 years. It's 2028, excuse me. My math tonight, it's not that good. But let's just say Barnes & Noble completely tanks. No one comes to the rescue. Can you still buy books? Oh, probably. From old bookstores. You can still buy books online. But what happens when you go online to buy a book? They recommend you use a Kindle if you're on Amazon. They recommend you use an iPad if you're on other services like Apple stuff, right? I could definitely tell you that electronic books made me really, really excited when I first heard about them as an option. And then having purchased, I don't know, 20 of them for my career, it, you know, the best I've ever had is a book and a PDF. Being able to scroll it on a big wide screen, that has been the best I've ever liked it. But I don't buy books on tape anymore, or books in electronic form anymore. I haven't gone into Barnes & Noble. I used to go to Barnes & Noble probably 2 to 3 times a week for a really long time, and then the other stores before they closed. And I probably haven't walked into a Barnes & Noble in 4 or 5 years. It's hard for me to even conceive of that. In the movie Rollerball, 1975, which again, the reason why I keep repeating certain things is that it's real important and it's got a tremendous amount of information in it, not just one little lesson. But one of the things that happened in that film was that the main character was being forced out of his job as a rollerballer, a sports thing. Go see my episode on Rollerball 1975 if you want to hear all about it. But at one point, he wants to know who makes decisions in the world. Who would ever decide that a guy in the prime of his life, who's the most popular rollerballer in the world, should stop? And the way the script wrote it was, who makes executive decisions? Because in the rollerball world, the corporations have saved us from all this nationalism. There's been a scandal in May of 2018, right at the very end of May of 2018, where a corporation censored an actress. And you know, I have no opinion about that personally. It doesn't make any sense to me at all what was going on in that situation. I don't follow either side of the equation. But I watched a very famous actor. I admire his acting skills. He posted in his Twitter and he said, I'm so glad that these corporations are taking a stand to defend the people. And I was like, oh, really? Well, that's interesting. You should go watch Rollerball, my brother, because you're retreating into the bosom of a corporation. Scary. Scary, scary, scary. So the main character of that film, he reserves some books on executive management, decision-making, whatever. He goes to what's called a library. He shows up. And this woman says, oh, well, those books are no longer available. You're more than welcome to read the corporate excerpts and summations of what the book was about, sort of the footnotes about the book, but you can't have the book. And so he stands there and he goes, so you're really not a library? No. And you're really not a librarian? Uh-uh, sorry. And so he leaves and he's like, holy shit. I can't figure out how the world works anymore because it's all digital and I don't have access to it. And the corporation that is the part of the world that he lives in, the Houston Corporation, has censored all the material. So he takes it into his own accord and he flies to Geneva, I believe is where he is. And he lands in Geneva and he goes to this big computer data center where there's a big computer and where he's going to ask the question of who makes executive decisions, which isn't really important to our story. He meets this old British gentleman, and he's a kind of a he's a big fan of Rollerball, and so he knows Jonathan E., played by James Caan, is the shit, and so he's willing to do anything for him. But on their journey from the office that they met in to the computer, they're walking, and they're talking. And the old man tells him that they somehow, I think it's they lost the 12th century that day. And he says, well, what do you mean you lost the 12th century? He says, oh, it'll probably turn up. But someone misplaced the hard drives, or the drives, or the tapes, or whatever. It's 1975, right? And in that little moment, you realize that when everything goes electronic, an entire century can disappear. From a quote-unquote mishap, just like NASA loses all of the evidence we went to the moon, right? It's funny, if you know anything about how schools get funded for technological advancements, then you'll be well aware that they don't usually have any money to do such things. In in rural America especially, when I was a kid, I was known for being a pretty good whiz kid with computers, and so at one point the district chairman or whatever the hell for, I think it's District 413 is my district in Kansas, he had me evaluate a Macintosh computer in about 1985 and said, you know, should we get some of these things? They're really expensive. And, you know, I'd already played with one a few months earlier, and I was like, well, these things are amazing. These things have more memory. They have 128K of RAM, and the ones in the lab have 32K of RAM. I think 64 with the pluses, so this has double the RAM. And I said, I think this is where it's all going. You know, look at this interface. I didn't realize it was called a GUI. I showed him menus and all that kind of stuff, and he had no idea to really how to comprehend what I was telling him. And they never got them because they didn't have any money. But now schools are finding pretty much infinite money to buy every single kid an iPad, every single kid some Android tablet, mostly iPads, which is even more expensive, right? Apple's brilliant with this. Get all the kids hooked on a particular brand, and then as they get older, they just stick to the brand, right? It's what they know. There have been events in time, for those of you who own DVRs, I don't know if maybe they're called something else around the world, but DVRs in America are the machines that record programs when you're not there, right? I've never owned one of these because I never want to watch anything on TV, but, you know, my cigar lounge has them. We record F1 races. But they've had conspiratorial shows air, or really odd things there. You can look this up, where the programs were erased off people's DVRs. So if you were trying to save it, the network or your cable provider was told by some higher state being, deep state, get that off everyone's drive, because that was never to air. It's interesting in this film, which is based off the book, which is actually pretty handsomely updated, I will say. There's a moment where things, a word ominous was spoken, which on a story level, it's kind of silly. This lady was revealing their secret weapon. I guess she was going to burn herself alive, so why not? But they said, you know, we're trying to get this off everyone's computers and wipe it off so people don't talk about this anymore. We know that in Britain alone, the amount of censorship is off the chain. You post something the state doesn't like, they not only suspend your account, but they have police that show up and arrest you. The amount of serfdom that is in Europe right now is really off the chain. That people would violate their own perceived rights without contemplating for a second what that means for their own rights, their own personal rights, right? You're walking around, I'll just do what I'm told. Watched a video by this whole thing, right? So we know that right now in Europe and Britain, which I'm going to lump them all together, they are institutionalizing censorship like draconian old school monarchy shit, like the old stamp tax. For those of you who don't know what the stamp tax was in Europe, there was something called the stamp tax. And what that meant, your mind's not going to get this initially, and then you're going to get it and you're going to go, holy shit, wow. Get it ready? Here's the part you won't get. Every piece of paper in the world had to be stamped with the royal crown symbol. You're going to go, what? Yeah, I'm going to repeat that just so you don't think I'm saying it incorrectly. Every piece of paper in your house had to be stamped. And you're thinking, well, that's just fucking weird. Why the hell, who would do that, blah, blah, blah. Okay, here's why. This is brilliant. In the name of absolute, pure, fucking, disgusting evil, this is brilliant. Because they don't have a constitution, or didn't have a constitution, just recently, 500 years ago, right, Magna Carta came and fucking went over there. They invented it, and then they let it go. And that's sadly what we have to defend over here, which is why we have the Second Amendment in America. Soldiers could show up at your house and raid your house to make sure that all the paper in your house had a stamp on it. It's not like a postage stamp. It's a stamp stamp. Well, it's a bullshit excuse to raid your house. And their idea was, well, if someone's going to plot against the government, they probably can't do it all inside their head. So someone's going to keep notes, cryptic or otherwise, they're going to write it down. And we will be able to find every piece of paper in this country that we suspect might be owned by someone who is disgruntled with the government. Okay, let's fast forward to post 9/11. President Bush signs in action the Military Commissions Act, which violates the Second Amendment, forcing communications companies to spy on you. The internet's here. All routers are designed to steal your information. Any of you think you have those security apps on your phone and, boy, I'm just not going to let anybody get on my stuff. It's like, you are kidding yourself. And there's so many truther channels that are pumping this shit. And it's sad. Either they're dumb and don't know how this works, or ignorant, I should say, and they don't know how internet security violations occur. Or they're just setting you up to make you feel comfortable while you donate money to their channel. But we don't really worry about pieces of paper anymore in your house. I mean, you got some paper in your printer, maybe you got a notepad, some post-its. That's usually about most homes. Old shit you had if you're over 40. What do we have today? We have digital bits that are organized in streams of bits that we refer to as files. And they don't need a stamp tax anymore. They just need a Military Commissions Act. And that allows your files to be viewed and stolen, especially if you transmit it over the web. That's where you're giving it away. You ever transmit anything over the web, you can convince yourself you got security and blah, blah, blah. They can't make an encryption key big enough to stump big supercomputers anymore. You can't. They'll crack it in seconds. They'll crack it. I mean, literally, a really giant key would take probably the average supercomputer nowadays, I don't know, I'm going to guess 3 seconds to get through. And that would be an insanely large public-private key that you use to encrypt a file. But now, where are the other files stored that are on your local hard drives? They're inside your house, and you won't necessarily transmit them over the internet. Well, that's where the operating systems come in, and they organize all of your data to be searched really quickly. Anybody who wants to find a file and get rid of it off your computer or put a file on a computer to frame you, they just walk through the back doors of the operating systems as long as you're on the internet, and they put it there. Email servers, it's all just files. Big, gigantic bins of little tiny files with big, giant serial numbers for names. They go to your mail bin in Unix. They can just insert an email in your chain and say, oh, look at you. You emailed all these people. Look at you said all these things that are really illegal. We're putting you in jail. We're going to give you the death penalty, whatever. Very simple to do. Books that go electronic could be revised just like a video game that updates itself, or a piece of software you like. So you take like a Microsoft Word and you run it and it goes boing. Hey, we got a new update. Do you want it? I mean, it's got all these new features. You're like, hell yeah, I want it. I don't want it to crash on me. This audio software, I used WavePad the second it crashed. I went online and found the update. And hopefully it doesn't crash. Books could be updated at the distribution hub. Anything you have on your computer, well, as long as you power it on, you've answered so many questions about, terms of use contracts. You know, it's like when you launch iTunes, it would take an attorney probably, I don't know, a solid month to parse the contract you're signing. But we want to use our iTunes, so we go, yes, I agree. There's been a flurry, by the way, of privacy policy updates in the last 7 days. And I mean, almost every single company that I'm a member of, including my Android phone. In order for me to continue using my fucking phone, I had to click through a new privacy policy, a new terms of use thing. Otherwise, my phone was going to be locked out. Something I paid money for. an asshole corporation can come in and go, oh, you know, I know you own your TV, but if you want to actually get power on, you're going to have to kiss our ass and sign this thing. And if you don't, you won't be able to use your device. Can you imagine that? You own your car. You bought some Mercedes. You paid 80 grand for it. You walk outside and there's a dude standing there with a clipboard and an attorney and a cop. And they say, well, I know you have to go to work, but if you don't sign away your life right now, we're going to keep your car disabled. The chip's not going to work. Why not? We do it everywhere else, right? We're literally slowly putting chains on ourselves. We're slowly getting into these straitjackets. It's the size of a full-grown, you know, man. It's like a big hospital gown, right? With all these shackles and stuff. We're just putting it on. How do we protect ourselves as citizens from losing history, losing all of our knowledge, having all those crazy theories, which I will not try to repeat on this episode, that we know are bunk, totally fake events in history and all this other stuff? How do we keep that from being solidified as truth? One of the great moments in Fahrenheit 451 is that they had retold, well, let me set the movie up for those of you who haven't seen it. It's near future. It appears that America, and only America, has done this new thing where they go into a true book burning phase, where there's a bunch of these firefighters that are firemen, I should say. They're not firefighters, they're firemen. They start fires, they don't put out fires. And what they do is they have 100% authority, bar none, to raid your house, just like a stamp tax soldier, to go in your house, find anything that's written down. And I mean anything that's written down. And if you have a digital copy of a book, you're still in violation. They'll destroy your computers. But if you find you with any books, they put the book down and the press shows up because they're called and it goes out over the airwaves and you get this positive, negative thumbs up from social media. And this is the new twist on it. And they put the books in the pile and then they burn the books in front of you. Then they take your citizen ID that's, I guess, stored in your hand, and they erase. I guess they use your fingerprints or something, and then they erase your identity from the computer, and you're kind of a complete nomad. All of your privileges are suspended, and you get like a sentence of 10, 15, 20, 25 years, whatever. And for those years, you're just cut out of the system, which I assume they didn't really give you an example of what those are, what that means. But everyone who isn't in the system is called an eel, like the fish. Poor eels get such a bad rep. These firefighters eventually, well, one, you realize that they're kind of worshiped like heroes in the populace because they burn books, right? And so, you know, one of these guys starts to wonder if what they're doing is right. That's pretty much the setup. But inside the story, they tell the story of Benjamin Franklin, who in real life was sort of a double agent for Britain and the U.S., but, you know, he's pretty famous for helping to found this country and what have you. But they retold the story that because in real life, Benjamin Franklin supposedly, I mean, they give away credit to British fucking assholes all the time, and I'm no offense against the Brits, but it's like, it's just this trend that we've had going for 1,000 years. White people invented everything, even the cotton gin. But the history is that he formed the very first fire brigade, fire department, to fight fires. But in this movie, they've twisted the truth in that he was the first fireman that burned books, and that they're just simply following this past that has been all revised to say that the world was horrible when people used to read books. That it promotes individualism and thus violence and thus unhappiness. But the whole world lives in this United States of America, in this movie, lives in this inquisition phase of, you know, report your neighbor if you see anything suspicious. One of those horrible societies. In the film, which I'm sure is in the book, they were wise enough to say to one of the readers, one of the old guys who was a reader and who knew history because he read, that as soon as he's dead and his generation dies off, no one's going to remember books ever existed. And because they're forbidden to exist, And because there's electronic equivalents now of recording information, they never will exist. Now, the good news is you find out that it's only the United States. At the beginning, you don't know if the whole world's doing this or whatever, but at the end, you find out it's only the United States that pulled this off. And the funny thing is that the country that is written into the end of this film as the saving country would probably be a country that would go way before the United States. So funny how that works. But one of the byproducts of the truth movement is the revision of history being revised back to probably a slightly more, if not profoundly more accurate version of what really occurred in certain points in time. You know, massacres that never occurred and massacres that occurred that were overlooked. We know that every single day we fight fake news. We do. We fight it, fight it, and fight it. Well, imagine if there wasn't a resistance factor. It's just reported, and that's it. You take it in, you believe it, and you go on. Now, if the world was truly a euphoric setup and not devolved into a THX-1138, where it's horrific existence, I mean, it's not horrific as maybe 1984 Brazil, but it's, you know, it's a clinically clean, but it is, you know, people are getting beat on television as a form of entertainment. We may look the other way the whole time. If everything was great. And then they could simply do what I was talking about at the beginning of the episode, which is to degradate the investment in mankind such that we get the scraps, we get the bare minimum to exist. What's interesting about mankind, as far as I've been able to deduce in my years of life, is that I believe that freedom is a genetic quality in man, and it's overwhelmingly powerful. The reason why our children go through rites of passage and start to reject their parents, especially in first world countries that have no formal rite of passage, except for maybe the Jewish culture that has the bar mitzvah, which I think is brilliant because you have to have a moment when you tell your child you're becoming a man. You have to have that christening moment. If you don't have it in your family and you're about to raise kids, or you're going to raise kids, or your kids are getting close to that phase, make one up. Make one up before they fully rebel. Because then you will hand them the baton of responsibility, and instead of feeling like they have to tell you to go fuck yourself, they will say, oh my God, I've just inherited a bunch of responsibility that now I need to become more mature to handle. And my parents trusted me with this responsibility. Make it a real responsibility. You know, a lot of times what parents will do is say, okay, 13 or 14 years old, somewhere in there, you turn over the keys to when a child has to go to bed. Maybe before. It's up to you, man. Only you know. But you tell your kids, okay, look, I'm going to let you stay up as long as you want, but here's the deal. You got to get up and go to school in the morning, and you got to get decent grades. So if you stay up too long and you're totally dragging ass in the morning, well, that's your responsibility. You need to get to bed earlier. If your grades start to degrade, you get to school, but you suck. Well, that's your responsibility. You got to bring that up. I'm entrusting you with this. This is what grown-ups do, and you've really turned out to be a great kid, and I'm entrusting you with this. They love that shit. And it's honestly what they've probably earned with their level of maturity in most cases, right? So in the early phase of life, we see kids rebel and we have to do whatever we can to wrangle that transformation. But what's interesting, if you watch any of these shows on Netflix, like Lock Up, where you've got a, you know, prison shows, you know, well, technically speaking, we all know that the masses rule when they want to. And we've seen mobs that do horrible things. The prisoners never have to obey. They do, though. They accept their fate. They accept their punishment in most cases. Sure, there's prison riots every once in a while. But whatever, what always happens in a prison riot? There's this envelope, and believe me, I'm not trying to cause prison riots or anything. There's always this sort of envelope of explosion. They explode within the compound borders, and they do, usually in a lot of cases, they take over the prison, 100%. What they never try to really do, and I've never heard this, maybe they have, whereas the whole prison leaves, right? The whole prison takes cars and keys, and they operate everything, and they open up all the doors, and they just fucking all disperse in random directions. 3,000 prisoners just running all over the countryside. Because in their brain, they still adopt the border of the prison as a restriction. You know, again, I just told the whole thing about the spike and the elephant. It's still the spike in the ground. And thank God that they still recognize that. A lot of them will accept their punishment and realize, well, what'll happen is I'll run and they'll catch me and they'll have more charges on me, which is probably the smart thing, right? So on one level, we see society, at least in America, rebel against overly strict regulations and laws on the people. We have the Constitution of the United States, and in this country, people will, you know, more often now, if they do not answer the question that they're a staunch Republican or staunch Democrat, they'll say they're constitutionalists. That's cool. That means you have a set of rules that's sort of based on common law, do no harm, and boom, we know how to behave as a society. The reason why I'm mentioning this is I'm trying to highlight your brain a little bit to the malleable nature of man's mind to accept both nature, the natural instinct for man to be free, and the ability for us to concede down to a paradigm of law, which may or may not be fair, just, or do no harm. For those of us over 40, remember old America. The interesting thing about it is that we almost can't conceive of the present America. The feminization of our men, the overmasculine nature of the women. And it's not really equaling a lot of happiness, is the thing. The reason why these groups are so angry is because that they don't like being in their own skin. You know, there's that famous, super obese girl who was screaming at some, I think it was a Milo event. She looked like the lady out of Monsters, Inc., right? I guarantee you, being that gigantic, as much as they will try to tell you that they feel fine with it, that girl was so absolutely obese, she's paying a lot of prices on a daily basis. You know, trying to find clothing, trying to deal with joint pain. I mean, wait till she gets older. I mean, there's all kinds of minuscule things that she's going to run into. She's out of control in her own life. So sure, she shows up to a protest at a rally, I mean, at a function that's actually organized and paid for, and tries to deny the guy on stage his ability to have his First Amendment. It's a rooted personal unhappiness being projected out into whatever scapegoat mechanism it can be projected into that is not going to root the anger back to themselves, right? The big thing in America right now, and probably around the world, I should just say it's a global thing, how foolish of me, is the divide. One of the things that was in Fahrenheit 451 that's interesting is they said they started really calling out some legitimate things the books can be used to do, which is divide. Divide through religious worship is one of the ones that's brought up a couple times in the film. Well, we know that that happens. We do. And sort of the theme that pops out of the film at the end is that even though it's not perfect when we're free, it's the way we want it to be in the end. Haven't you ever had the thought of like, well, it'll be interesting to see mankind, say, in 100,000 years if we don't become extinct, or even 50,000 years. I know it sounds like a long ways out there, but I'm pretty sure man was around 50,000 years ago. Okay. Are we going to shake this all out? I mean, we have been around for probably 100,000 years. It doesn't matter if God made us or it was evolution. It doesn't matter. We've been around that long as pretty hairless Homo sapiens. Okay. We still have all the races, don't we? Is it because we didn't make boats and planes and trains? Not really. I mean, how do you think Hawaii got populated by Polynesian people? We did find pretty much every continent with a sort of a general mean of genetic qualities. Look at the Native Americans. They're much, much different than the Incas. Who knows what the pre-Incas look like? I think Australia was pretty much Aborigine, and that was it until Britain started dropping off their citizens there. By the way, I heard this interesting story from an Australian YouTuber who was talking about the idea that Australia was a penal colony, and he wasn't being 1,000% serious, but he called it out as bullshit, and he said, you know, what's really true is that they just threw all the dissidents from Europe into the ocean. I should say Britain. But they would put you on a boat, take you out in the ocean, throw you in the ocean, and then came back and told people that they took them to an island. And that eventually they did inhabit Australia way past this phase of the penal colony thing. And then they said, yeah, these are the people that came from Australia that were put here during the penal phase, right? It's a very interesting idea because that could be very, very true. I've never researched it. Just a very interesting twist on the story. But there you have it. How? I'm going to get to two other things here before we close out. But, you know, a lot of times you think of book burning, you think of huge changes to history. You know, just blanking out history, for one. And the funny thing in the film was that everyone took these eye drops that were full of a chemical cocktail, which made them forget their past. Everybody just absolutely accepted the fact that they couldn't remember their past. You were only ever living in the now. That's just interesting. So you could never get indoctrinated very much besides the reinforcement of whatever's happening in the now. And that world was all about the now. And the now rules, you know. But maybe it's just little tiny changes in history that could make all the difference in the world, right? Now, back in season one, maybe a little bit in season two, I talked about obviously the dumbing down of the world. And one of the big things is to remove language, to reduce the amount of words that we use such that our ability to articulate and express ourselves is gone as a missing art. Now, I've worked with several people in academic institutions. And I always use the time I have with them, which is usually fairly rare and for me priceless, to ask them questions about sort of where we are within celebrated universities, like big names that I've spoken at. And, you know, one of the most educated people I've ever talked to told me that the average high school student graduates with 1,200 words in their vocabulary, which might sound like a lot, but wait for it. And someone with a four-year degree who takes a literary track gains another 1,000 words. So an average four-year graduate with a literary degree has about 2,200 words in their vocabulary. That the books today, your Harry Potter books and all the books that become famous, use a very conservative word supply of unique words. Now, rewinding back to Civil War soldiers in America, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's in the 1860s, the average vocabulary of a Civil War soldier, as discovered by historians who have been trying to translate the letters home that these people wrote each other, thousands and thousands of these letters, was they found out very quickly the college professors could not translate these letters in their entirety. And the reason why was the vocabulary was so absolutely huge that they didn't know what these guys were saying. When totaled, the average vocabulary of a Civil War soldier whose average education was eighth grade was 12,000 words. A little bit of math, that's 10 times the amount of words that a high school student gets in America today. 10 times. Who knows what an academic in the 1860s was coming out with, you know? I don't know if 12,000 even demands anything more than perhaps, you know, industry terms for if you're getting into physics, you got a bunch of physics terms, you go into medicine, you have a bunch of medicine terms or whatever, but I would wager you do gain at least another 1,000 words going through school in the 1860s, right? Now, America was much more meat and potatoes back in those days, so at eighth grade, you were considered pretty much an academic, but if you look back on their vocabulary, it's huge. There's a chart out there for those of you who are interested. You can look up there's a chart that tracks the amount of words that a particular rapper has used, and it, you know, it's essentially sort of like an inadvertent IQ register to say, okay, Eminem, the rapper, has done this many unique words in all of his raps, so they assume he's, you know, he's at this level on the bar, on the line graph. And I read through this thing, and most of the rappers of today are way back in the kind of preschool level of words. I mean, some of these guys could barely get out of the paper bag who are so popular today, right? They've got about 100 words they're using for all their raps. It's really funny. And the one that shocked me, there was some super academic rapper who was in number one place. But one of the second or third folks, last time I saw this diagram, was LL Cool J. I couldn't believe it. I was like, because his stuff is so beautiful and simple to understand. But, you know, yeah, he's way up there at the top. It's amazing. It's cool, right? But removing our words, it affects your brain. It affects how you communicate. It can sometimes, if you go way below a certain threshold, you immediately sound ignorant, even though you may not be ignorant. One of the, and I mentioned this, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever, my marathon lockup. Is that what it's called? Yeah, lockup. Some of the wisest souls I've ever seen in my life are these old guys that have been in jail for 30, 40 years. They're going to die there. And they are giving their advice to the young folks, or just giving it to the camera during interviews. And their English is, unfortunately, atrocious. I mean, it's just really bad. You know, misconstrued, double negatives and all this other stuff. But what's interesting about it is that these guys have been in there so long and have had so much time to think, that what they're saying pound for pound in terms of value is off the scale. Like, super wisdom, man. And I find that fascinating. My hope is that the internet might have a side effect, and that people, I think, on average, read more than they did perhaps 15 years ago. I've also said on the show several times that writing poetry is one of the best ways to utterly supercharge your brain. And it's almost like an alien machine you hook up to your brain if your IQ was, you know, 120, and you begin writing poetry for, let's say, a minimum of 2 years, because you're going to go through all these phases of writing crap, and then you're going to write really good. You're going to add 10 to 20 points on your IQ, and people are going to notice, and it's you doing it to yourself. But eventually, you know, you'll start writing poetry initially, and one, you'll start rhyming everything, which you don't have to do if you don't want to, but you will run out of, you'll get so tired of using the same words, right? Those who write poems about loving someone or having an amazing loving experience, the word ecstasy comes out really, really fast, and then you write ecstasy four times in four different poems, and you realize, I got to find a different way to say this. I got to parse the word, parse the meaning, parse the feeling. You know, what do we say half the time when we talk about how we could make the world a peaceful place if, some of us say, oh, everyone drops acid for a week. That might help. But the other big one is just simply getting one thought in everyone's mind about peace and the benefit of how much we love each other or love our lives. We really don't have any beef with anyone else. Those who always are fucking with other people, we educate them on, hey, we don't want to be messed with. And this is why, and so on and so forth. But it's always like a data pack of information in the brain that is sort of the root of all peacemaking magic wand solutions. Well, if we as human beings allow our communication to be dumbed down, we're unable to articulate what we are thinking in our minds, that means that you couldn't do a show like this, right? It'd be really tough. There's so many nuances of emotion, you know. So you know that when you, let's say you haven't, but let me just explain this. For those of you who have painted in your lifetime, even a house, you just paint the side of a house. You know there's a big 6-inch brush you can use if you're not using a sprayer. Well, let's use the sprayer first, right? Sprayer's doing the big sections, and then you move to a 6-inch brush, and then you move to a curved, like a, you know, a wedged brush that's going to get in there, and then you can even, you know, paint a model, and it's paint a painting, and you just keep getting your brush smaller and smaller. And what happens What is the requirement to use a smaller brush? It's typically skill and talent. Okay. When you are communicating, you have coarse words that have big, giant meanings. Like if I ever say the F-bomb on this show, the funny thing is I don't know that I've ever used it in the traditional sense of its definition, which is copulation or intercourse. I'm saying it as a expletive to add some sort of flavor and emphasis to something I am about to say or that I have just said. You know, the F-bomb is one of the words that has the most definitions in the world, right? Almost all dirty words have such a thing. It's like the funny one about the word dude, you know. Dude, or dude, right? Just me saying it those two different ways. Imagine coming to America and trying to figure out the difference between those two. You mean those two emphases, you know, it means something completely different. Like, yeah, it does. I'm sorry, we're so weird. But those are the nuances of language. What also starts to happen is you will realize the more vocabulary that you build, and again, reading is what I'm really trying to point this at. Reading helps you see words spelled, which helps you become a better speller, which helps you pronounce words correctly because you will understand that the word definitely does not have an A in it, okay? Right? That's one of the most misspelled words on the internet. Definitely, right? But the more words you know, the less you will ever be tied up in your own gut saying, I'm not able to communicate what I am feeling, and I am failing with the person I am talking to because I can't get across what the hell I'm trying to say. And that's super frustrating. But the second you can articulate like a ballet, and I mean you are hitting every bump and stop and jump and whatever, and people are watching you, which means listening to you, and they are like, oh my God, that sounded perfect. You said what was in my mind that I was unable to put into words. It's not about showing off in the end, but it will just make you live in your own skin that much better. And even if you want to protest or debate someone, you believe something completely different than they do, the more you're articulate, the more that you can get across your notion and perhaps get someone to see your perspective better, right? We have to be careful with letting the entire world become electronic. You know, a lot of you will study the power of EMP waves, right? Electromagnetic pulse waves that are now weaponized. They're 100% weaponized. They've been weaponized for probably 40 years. They can ignite a bomb, electronic burst, and fry every single piece of microelectronics around. They can fry your hard drives. Imagine they blow out the controller in your hard drive. Let's say the disk itself, for the most part, is intact. The data is still on the disk. Have you ever paid to recover data off a disk before? You damn near have to be a major corporation or a millionaire to pay for shit to come off a drive. It's that expensive. It is really, and I've been to the laboratory down in Irvine, and I got a full tour by the guy that started the company, and it is unbelievably difficult to do this work. I mean, it is a meticulous laboratory thing. It's painstaking. It's almost so hard that if you had the money to start that company because you think there's a lot of demand, you will find it hard to have employees have enough physical constitution to do the work. That's how hard it is. And then, of course, you're inadvertently giving all of your data to somebody else, right? For those of you who take photographs and you can't imagine losing your photographs that are on your hard drive, do me a favor. Get them printed into a book. There's a million services out there. You upload your photos into a book and you have them printed and it costs nothing. And they print it on non-acidic paper so it lasts forever. Do that for me and send copies of it to your relatives so if your house burns to the ground, it doesn't matter. Your memories are on bookshelves all around your family. If it's important enough that you would cry your eyes out if it got burned up, either get it printed or take the printed ones you have or the ones you've already, you know, Kodak'd out back in the old days, get them scanned, cleaned up, put in a book, and sent out to people. It's pennies on the dollar for your tears, let me tell you. If your house burned down, I'll give you an example of how silly this is. Your house burns down and you're looking at your whole life disappear. And I say to you, I walk up to you and I said, would you spend $500 to bring it all back? And you're just crying your eyes out. And you're like, well, fuck yeah. And if I said, would you pay $5,000 to bring all your memories back? And you're like, yes, I would pay $50,000 to bring all my memories back, to put that house right back where it was without it being burned down. And then I turn to you like an asshole and I just say, well, for $250, you could have done it. You could mail a hard drive to a relative with all your files on it. You know, maybe it's locked, encrypted or whatever, if you're really worried about your secret stuff. But you could send a hard drive. What's a hard drive? 4 terabyte hard drive you can get for $90 now. 4 terabytes. Do you really have 4 terabytes of life? Probably not. But there's one more thing about the power of words. I mean, there's a bunch of things about the power of words. It's also extremely important. And, you know, this isn't necessarily directly related to the idea of being electronic or being printed, but if printed paper, which doesn't flicker off and on, is more memorable to your mind, then this is important, which is that it improves the frequency in your brain to realize who you are as a human being. You look in the mirror, and you have thoughts that are constructed into words. I'll give you two halves to this equation. If you look in the mirror and you like yourself completely, then you're not really worried about what words describe that beautiful person in the mirror. And hopefully that's the way you feel. But if you ever proverbially or symbolically look in the mirror and you don't like something, it doesn't have to be your physical form, okay? It can just be who you were last night when you had too many drinks or when you got in a little argument with someone you love. You need words in your brain to condition yourself for change. You need to be able to take the cloud of a really angry moment with someone that might have lasted 10, 20, 30 minutes, and you need to be able to slow down time, get in there with a microscope, and parse everything that triggered the next thing, and say, okay, what could I have done personally to not get so agitated, to not say the wrong thing in a flippant way? We've all been there. Right, you say the thing you probably shouldn't have said, and then you blow it up. You're not going to lose, man. That's part of why men do it. So these words are very, very important to you. Okay. Now there's one of the compliments I get on this channel. Okay, and I'm going to tell you the reward I receive from your comments, and then I'm going to tell you the Paul Harvey to the story, which for me is sort of funny, which is that I get a compliment on this show probably once a week about, you know, I've got 315 videos, so I see comments that are compliments that you don't see, unless you're going back through all the comments of every video. I have a nice aggregate, so I'm lucky. But someone will say it's very articulated. You put it into words, and I was struggling to put this into words, and so that's one of the compliments I get. Okay. And thank you very much. Trust me, love it. But when I moved to California in 1987, I was probably pretty good at speaking words, okay? I'm not sure exactly why, because again, I wasn't a big, giant fictional reader. Oh, maybe I just paid attention. But I'd read tons and tons of technical books, and then sorted it out in my mind and re-explained it to people such that it was easy to understand. Maybe that's what I did to get my vocabulary up. But here's what you need to know. I was one of the worst spellers the world has ever created since man was invented. Horrible. And now I'm extremely good at it. Okay. I don't know how I would do in a spelling bee with all that weird shit those kids have to spell, but I'm just talking about everyday communications. When I write fluently. It's just whatever I can think of in my mind, I can pull it out, you know, orders of magnitude over even my inner voice. Just when I start writing, it all starts flowing. Okay, so how the hell did I get from being essentially illiterate when it came to writing? Like, I was really good in English class in school, don't get me wrong, but it was never testing my vocabulary. I only had a couple creative writing exercises, but anytime I had to write something out, when I look back, it's just like, my God, I was transposing words, words that, you know, son, S-O-N, son, S-U-N. I probably didn't make a mistake with that particular word, but I was messing up a ton. Your and your, like you are abbreviated. I would screw up that consonant. Then and then. Just tons and tons and tons of these words. Almost an alarming rate of like, geez, this guy's breaking world's records with misspelling things and transposing words. Now, had I gone into some sort of clinic today, they would have said I was dyslexic. I wasn't dyslexic. I was ignorant. I was dumb. Okay. But I had a guy pull me aside in 1991, and he was a Norwegian guy, speaks perfect English. He's a British English. He was just an amazing guy. And he was my cube mate. He was like on the other side of the partition. And he said to me, he goes, he was always copied on emails that I was writing. And he was so friendly. Okay. This is the other thing I always have to try to remember to do. And hopefully if you have the same privilege of helping someone out, you can be like my buddy, Ron. But he goes, I noticed that when you write, you have a tremendous amount of grammatical errors, spelling errors, and transposing. But because he sat next to me and I was in a technical support department, he realized that I was saying words incorrectly. Literally using, again, vowels that don't exist, inserting consonants that don't exist into the words. And so he made a deduction that to this day I've never heard anyone say. Ever, not to someone else, not to me. And it was just, in my opinion, it was at the very, he could have started a whole new Hooked on Phonics class based off what he was telling me. It's not phonics based, but it's the following. He says, look, I think I figured you out. He says, I don't think you know how to spell anything, do you? I look at your emails and it's crazy. We didn't have spell checkers that underlined everything in your writing back in the day. He says, I don't think you know how anything's spelled. So one, you say words incorrectly because you don't know how they're spelled. You're spelling them some chaotic way in your brain. He says, I think if you can learn how to spell, you're going to pretty much fix most of your words, but you do need to go and study words because you've got a bunch of things mixed up. You don't know possessive your versus you are about to do something, right? So here's the commitment I made to myself. Microsoft Word, probably since 1987, when I first started writing novels, which I don't do anymore, it has spell checker. And at first, I would just go, yes, yes, yes. Oh, gosh, thank you for fixing all my problems. But now my transposing word problem wasn't being corrected by the grammar checkers that exist today, like than and then, right? Than being a comparative between two things, and then being a reference in time, right? Affect and effect. That's the latest one I fixed. So before too long, I would spell check. And because I was writing so much content, so much fictional content, you know, I'd sit down and write 8 pages, dense pages of novel stuff in one sitting, and then I'd go back and spell check it. So my commitment I made to myself was before allowing the spell checker to fix anything, I would see what I had done wrong in the spelling and see what they were doing right in the correction. And I'm going to tell you, it was a super quick fix to my spelling problems. My brain was so tired of spelling wrong because I think I knew subconsciously I was just hurling it out there. And I thought, well, you get it, so there you go, right? Within a couple of years, my spelling had probably increased 80 to 90%. Grammar, that took another 10 years. Now with today's grammar checkers, it's phenomenal. The one I use all the time is Grammarly. You'll see these pre-rolls on videos on YouTube for Grammarly. And they say, right inside there, they go, if you write, you need this plugin. It fits in your web browser, but you can have it in all of your software on your computer usually. It's free. I know I might have some spy thing where they're, you know, transmitting your words someplace to get them checked out. It doesn't matter. Let me tell you, man, as long as you're not, you know, colluding with the Russians, get the goddamn plug-in. If you have any issues with your grammar, you'll be stunned how grammar rules evolve over time, and you will have adopted something that is just wrong, you know, and it's no longer accepted, or you don't have to put a comma there anymore, that kind of stuff. It's really interesting, but it makes you amazing at writing. The other trick I use is that on my Macintosh, I use the text-to-speech feature, which in my computer, it's option escape key, will read back to you in a voice that you pick inside your control panel at whatever speed you want. They have beautiful voices. I use a British Indian woman, and it's like Sonora or something like that. It's an S name. That's not the name, but it's something like that. And she's just beautiful. And I have her speak it back to me. And then you'll find you have plurals missing or plurals on there because you revised the sentence, you know, and you forgot to take out some of the tenses. You have a was where there should be a were, an is instead of an are. And again, Grammarly will fix it. A lot of automated software on your computer will fix it. But if I'm writing at 2 o'clock in the morning, a really important email to my boss, I use that software to prove. And if you just relax your mind and listen, it hears mistakes. It's interesting. Because kids don't read anymore, on average, we are seeing like epidemics in bad English, at least. I would be fascinated for any of you who speak another language, do me a favor, comment in the comment section about the average vocabulary of a person in your native language and whether or not people speak correctly. Is it degrading in French and German and all these different languages? I mean, let me know, because that's a fascinating fact I've never heard in America. It's a slippery slope. But the one that's really out there now is the difference between seen and saw. I have seen, I saw. You know, and I get these comments all the time on YouTube, and no offense to you guys still struggling to put this together. As I just said, I've been there, man, trust me. But I will see all this all the time, you know, people saying, I seen the movie, da-da-da, and I'm like, ooh. The problem with some of these issues that reading solves for you is that the job interview ends very quickly. When some of these catastrophic problems happen, you want to do a follow-up email with the people you just interviewed, and you do a definitely with an A. I definitely like the meeting. Definitely like meeting you today. I definitely want your job from you. And they're like, oh my God, what else is wrong in this person's mind? And there may not be anything else wrong with that person's mind, just that one word that's misspelled. And, you know, in America, what's happening is the teachers of schools, usually K through 12 is where it's really bad. The amount of teachers that speak in broken English, and I'm not talking about some ghetto. I'm talking about, you know, what would be considered, you know, your middle class, upper middle class schools have these teachers that can't speak English. And these poor kids. You want to blame the kid? You want to blame the kid's parents or whatever? I mean, yeah, your parents, you need to correct your kid's English, but wow. I mean, we're not putting our best foot forward in a lot of industries, right? But to finish up on the core subject line, the book burning doesn't need to happen. It's happening in a digital way. They only burned books back in the day because the books were the only thing that they had to store information in. Now it's all digital. If books cease to exist, then I'm pretty sure they are going to cease to exist, unless there's some sort of like vinyl LP, you know, renaissance of printed material. Everything's going to go electronic. And just like the DVRs, they could go back and revise books. And in case of technical books, that might be absolutely fantastic. In the case of, you know, I helped publish a book with the Rockstar, and we had to come out with a second edition because someone saw their name in the book and threatened to sue us after giving us permission to use their name. And we don't use last names or anything like that, but they said basically it was okay to talk about the moment, and then they had a change of heart. We'd already published the first edition, so I had to go back and get rid of it. That would have been nice to say, okay, I clicked this button, and now this lady's not mad at me anymore because she's a part of this story she doesn't want to be a part of. And I can guarantee her that the only people that will ever know this are the people that read the first edition and remembered in their mind. You know, here's the rub, though, that I want to absolutely close off with, okay? If this is a new concept to you at all, about everything going digital, and then they can lose history, they can revise it, whatever. You know, how long do you keep an iPad for? Not that long. How long do you keep a computer for? Not that long. Well, if the form of which we store everything goes from local hard drives to cloud technology, and you can't afford to pay your monthly fee to keep it in the cloud, then you're going to have to probably give up some data or have it on a drive and you're never going to see it again, right? Because the computers that are able to read it expire. You need to understand this. What I'm asserting in this episode was a meeting that happened a long time ago. I'm going to suggest the meeting about, guys, do you realize if we make everything electronic for kids and we get rid of all the books in the world and everything goes electronic and digital, we can control the world, man. We can absolutely erase the fact that certain societies ever existed. Ever existed. Those pottery pieces from the Greeks, well, that's all anyone will know. We'll have a little fire and those will go away, right? We'll just erase a whole race. You won't even know who the fuck you are, right? The people that control the planet currently have had this conversation. They know what they're doing. That's why schools don't have any problem finding funding to make this agenda move quickly. In some cases, it is great that a kid does not have to carry, I used to have to carry probably, 8 to 10 pounds of books between class because I didn't want to go to my locker every day. Now, I could have just carried a 10-inch iPad. The tech is great. I think it's wonderful. I hope it keeps going. We just have to have some sort of balance. What if private colleges have higher academic rates, smarter kids, they get better jobs, they seem to understand the material better, and the only difference between that school and some state-funded college is that the state-funded college gives every kid a tablet, or says buy your own, and then this is how you download your book, and the upper Ivy League school still has printed books. What if that was the difference? What would you do as a student? Would you go get the book? Would you try to really concentrate on your iPad to make sure you get it better? Do we pass some sort of policy about archiving information in written form? I don't think you could convince anybody to do that. Those of you who love books, just like me. You go to a bookstore and the smell of all that printed paper, it brings back memories. It, the one thing I get when I go into a bookstore is I get this fantasy in my brain. And I've told my girlfriend this so many times, she laughs her head off. And I say, wouldn't it be cool to have that stopwatch from the Twilight Zone that you click it and everything stops? And you don't age anymore. And you can read every single book that you want to read in that bookstore. Maybe even the crap you don't like, just so you can make fun of it like a bad movie. But all that knowledge that's good in there, you get it in your mind. You understand finances and law and the good science that's undisputable science. You get to read all those fictional books. Get to read every single book from your favorite author. All the New Age crap. All the philosophy. That's a routine thought I have in the first, 60 seconds when I go into a really good bookstore. It's just like, damn, wouldn't it be awesome? It sucks that I only live so many years, right? For me, I still find a book extremely endearing and warm and comforting. There's nothing quite like just laying in your bed, you have the book on your bookshelf or your nightstand or whatever, and you pick it up and you just, you did that little routine where you, You hold up the page you're not reading with your hand because you're on your back, and you read, or you lay on your side and you read it, but you got to get your light to look at it properly. You're trying to have your low light in your room, but you flip through the pages and then you just find yourself in a different world for a little while. Doesn't matter what the subject is. You get tired. You bend the page over so you know where you are, and you put it back on your nightstand. You roll over and your brain's just like all charged up with amazing visions of things. Maybe it's a No Country for Old Men theory, right? Maybe we're just going to be old-fashioned folks. Maybe the folks that used to make mud tablets really hated papyri. You know, well, the whole world's going to go up in papyri. You know, you can lose your whole library with a fire there, Alexander. And he's like, no, that'll never happen. Meanwhile, we're still reading Sumerian texts and mud tablets to this day. We're still reading hieroglyphs. What are your feelings about this whole thing? Do you like books? Do you like electronic stuff? Let me know if you've ever read anything on an electronic book and had a problem remembering it later versus picking up a piece of paper. If you have a solution that keeps both of them alive, let me know. How many years do you think it's going to take before we lose all books in the world? If you haven't been, go to deepthoughtsradio.com for all the feeds. There's video, audio, lock Facebook group, Patreon, and a little store. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.